we get things rolling, though, this afternoon by getting on board the G&M Family Market phone line and welcoming into the program the longtime film critic of Entertainment Weekly and the author of a wonderful new book, Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Chris Nashawaty joins us. Chris, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
Man, I love the book so much. And obviously, this was a labor of love for you. You put in quite a bit of time putting this all together and gathering up these interviews for close to 20 years, right?
Yeah, I mean, off and on, I've been sort of talking to a lot of these people, you know, with my day job at Entertainment Weekly. So, you know, I'll always fit in a question here or there about one of my favorite movies. And, yeah, it was a lot of work, but when you're writing about Caddyshack, it somehow doesn't feel like work.
Well, and I love the story in the acknowledgments to the book about when you were working on the piece for Sports Illustrated that was the basis for the book and waiting for that one missing puzzle piece, as you explained it, and how excited it must have been to finally get that call from the elusive Bill Murray.
Yeah, I mean, Bill Murray is sort of the holy grail, you know, the white whale of the whole thing. He's tough to pin down. He's a quirky guy, and he doesn't have any of the usual sort of publicity machinery that most Hollywood actors or celebrities have. You know, he doesn't have a publicist or a manager or an agent. He just sort of is a freewheeling operator. And what he does have is a 1-800 number, which is sort of tough to get your hands on. But once you get it, you leave Bill a message. And there isn't an outgoing message. It's just a beep. And you make your case about why he should call you back. And I, for about a month, left messages telling him what I was working on. And fortunately, at the last minute, he gave me a call, which was sort of, I couldn't believe it was happening until it was all over.
Well, it was wonderful reading about the making of the film, but I enjoyed the early parts of the book just as much. And that was the backstory, the coming together of the Harvard Lampoon, the National Lampoon people, the folks from Second City and those who had gone on to Saturday Night Live, and how all the members of that group changed the face of comedy in the 70s and 80s.
Yeah, I mean, you really can't talk about Caddyshack without talking about this comedy revolution that was happening in the 70s. So the book is really, you know, it is very heavy on Caddyshack, but it takes, you know, 100 pages to get there, because I really think that it's important to understand the roots of where all of these comedians were coming from. I think it covers really a decade in comedy between 1970 and 1980, when everything was changing. You mentioned Second City, Saturday Night Live, the National Lampoon. This was a new generation, sort of a counterculture generation of satirists who were really a little bit more wielded a sharper knife than most comedians at the time. And, you know, their comedy, you could argue, it was the most influential generation of comedy that Hollywood ever produced.
And for all the big names involved in the making of Caddyshack, for me, and I feel like maybe for you as well, the central figure in all of this is a guy that unfortunately not as many people know today, and that's the amazingly talented Doug Kenny.
Yeah, Doug Kenny is really sort of the through line of the book, just because he was involved in so many aspects of this decade of comedy. You know, for those who don't know him, you know, he was, everyone I talked to would say he was the smartest, the funniest, the most charming guy of their generation. And these are some, you know, he was running in good company, so that's saying a lot. You know, he was an editor at the Harvard Lampoon. He was the founder of the National Lampoon. He wrote Animal House. He wrote and produced Caddyshack, and, you know, he just, everything he touched in some way sort of turned to gold. He was a real wildly talented guy, but also a deeply troubled guy, and it was a time when his peers of his generation, people like Belushi and Chevy Chase and a lot of other people, you know, freely talk about getting swept up in the drug culture, and especially cocaine, and that would eventually be Doug's undoing, and he... not to give anything away, I mean, it's public record, but he passed away shortly after the movie opened, thinking that it was a failure, and he never got to live long enough to see that, you know, people are still talking about and quoting Caddyshack nearly 40 years later.
I feel like, too, throughout the making of this movie, there are these dichotomous pairs of folks involved in the production, and two of them would be Doug Kenny and Harold Ramis, a producer, director, who shared a comedic sensibility, but little else.
Yeah, I mean, they couldn't be more different as people, which makes them perfect partners in a way. You know, Kenny was sort of, you know, the class clown in the back of the room lobbing spitballs as a teacher and sort of acting up. Brilliant, but just sort of a real troublemaker. And Ramis was more sort of cerebral. You know, he worked on Second City television, which was, you know, sort of the Canadian counterpart to Saturday Night Live. You know, it was a little bit more benign, less hard-hitting, but a brilliant guy. And together, they really it was a great sort of chemistry they had together. You know, you really don't have to go any further than looking at a movie like Animal House, which they wrote together. You know, that movie was made for $2 million and ended up grossing something like $140 million. It was the top grossing comedy of all time when it came out. You know, and it's still a great movie. Those guys really had a sense of what the baby boomers wanted to see on the big screen, and they tapped into it before anyone else did.
We're talking with Chris Nashawaty about his book Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. The people at Orion, the studio behind the film, had a real hands-off approach, but they wanted some names, they wanted some star power, and they turned to a couple of guys who were doing very well at the time, Rodney Dangerfield, who had just impressed everybody, as you point out in the book, with a series of great appearances with Carson on The Tonight Show, and then Ted Knight, fresh off the success on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. But those two also could not have been more different in their approach to things.
Yeah, I mean, it's sort of this movie it does have, as you mentioned, sort of lots of pairs of opposites, Dangerfield and Knight. Couldn't have been more different. You know, Rodney, this was, Caddyshack was his first real acting experience. And he had no idea what he was doing at all. And, you know, he didn't even know what the word action meant. And Ted Knight, of course, was, you know, professionally trained actor. You know, to him, acting was about learning the lines, coming to the set prepared, maybe 15 minutes early, and saying your lines down to every period, comma, and exclamation point. You know, so in a scene that they have together, many scenes they have together, Rodney was just spouting off whatever would pop into his mind, even if it wasn't in the script, usually if it wasn't in the script. And meanwhile, Ted Knight is, like, trying to keep up with him and is not used to this sort of comedy, and he was just growing more and more enraged as the scenes went on. So a lot of the anger and rage that you see in his Judge Smales character, that is not acting at all. That is the real deal.
And Ted Knight didn't do drugs, didn't drink. And I think the first scene, the arrival of Dangerfield on set, as you mentioned in the book, he sees someone, I think, at the hotel and says, "Is that weed? I love weed. Where are we going?"
Another comparison is that Ted Knight was probably, you know, someone jokes in the book, and I'm not sure it's much of a joke, that Ted Knight was the only person on the movie who wasn't high. And, you know, he just was of a different generation. You know, this was 1979 in Florida, which was pretty much the gateway into the country for cocaine. And these were young people who had a lot of money to spend, a blank check from the studio, very little oversight, not a ton of experience. So, you know, they partied really hard on this movie. And when you hear some of the epic partying stories that are in the book, it's sort of amazing that a movie came out of this at all.
Well, yeah, especially when they turned in the first draft. And as you write, it was, a couple of hundred pages long, the initial treatment, and surprisingly didn't include the character of Carl Spackler.
Yeah, a normal Hollywood script is usually about 120 pages, and if it's a comedy, it's a little bit shorter. This one, you know, I think one of the producers compared it to having Moby Dick plopped on their desk, or War and Peace, or you know, something like that. It was just they didn't know what to make of it, and you know, these guys just didn't know what they were really doing. They had to cut a lot of it out, and what they ended up doing, as you mentioned, Carl Spackler Bill Murray's sort of demented assistant greenskeeper character is nowhere in the first draft of the script or the second or the third. He was largely invented by Bill Murray on the set. Bill Murray was only there a week, and he didn't have any lines written for him. He just made up that whole character out of whole cloth. And that just shows you what a great ad-libber he was at the time. You know, Ramis was the director of the movie, was trained at Second City. He had total faith in his performers that they could come up with something better on the day than anything they could possibly write. So, you know, why not just turn on the camera and see what happens? And what happened was something like Cinderella Story. It's just sort of a remarkable thing that, you know, would never happen in Hollywood today. They would never take that kind of risk.
Well, and were you surprised to learn from interviewing people that the script pretty much got thrown out early on? There was so much improvisation, and even the centerpiece of the movie shifted from being about the caddies to being about these larger-than-life figures.
Yeah, the whole script was really based on one of the three writers, Ramis, Doug Kenny. The third one was Brian Doyle Murray, Bill's older brother. And the story was really based on the Murray's youth experiences. There were nine Murray kids. They grew up just north of Chicago, a middle-class family. So in order to pay their way through Jesuit school, they worked as caddies over the summers, you know, all through their teenage years. And they had great stories about the people that they caddied for and their fellow caddies. And so all of those stories found their way into the script. But, you know, having so many great improvisers like Murray and Chase and Dangerfield on the set, the script quickly fell into the trash. So the original idea was that it was going to be Michael O'Keefe's Danny Noonan character and his Irish girlfriend and one of the other caddies as sort of a love triangle. And all the characters that we think of as famously being the stars of the movie now were really just incidental side characters who would pop up here and there. But they were so much funnier in the dailies that they said, let's get rid of this love triangle story and just follow these funny people and just sort of throw the script in the trash and just make it up as we go, and we'll see what happens when we get to the editing room.
And Bill Murray's character of Carl was actually an offshoot of a character he had done earlier back in the Second City days, the Honker, right?
Yeah, that was one of Bill's most famous characters at Second City in Chicago, the Honker. He would just sort of twist his mouth up into that, you know, crazy grin and just give this mush mouth delivery, and you couldn't quite tell if the character was drunk or maybe brain damaged or what, or maybe both, who knows. And that was just a character that he played all the time. So people who knew Bill and knew his work at Second City and at Saturday Night Live, they knew who this character was. You know, it was something he would trot out at parties and all that. But they didn't know that he was going to play the character that way until he arrived on the set and the camera started rolling for his first scene, which was the Dalai Lama scene. And he just opened his mouth and did Carl as the Honker, and everyone just had to bite their fists in order not to crack up and ruin the take.
I love the story that you share in the book as well. Fairly late in the process of making the movie, they realize they haven't had a scene with Murray and Chase together, and there had been not just animosity, but a full-on fight backstage at Saturday Night Live. How did they get them together, and did that sort of change their relationship?
It did, yeah. You know, Bill Murray and Chevy Chase were not friends at all coming into this movie. You know, Chevy was the breakout star on the first season of Saturday Night Live, and before he went off to have a Hollywood career. Bill Murray was his replacement on the show. And for those who were left behind, when Chevy left, there was this sense that Chevy had sort of gotten a big ego. And so when he came back to guest host in 1978, Bill Murray, as the new guy, sort of felt it was his job to be the Avenger a little bit. And so backstage before the monologue, he and Chevy got into a fist fight. And so when the two of them 2 years later arrived on, or about a year and a half later, arrived on the set of Caddyshack in Florida, everyone was walking on eggshells. They did not know how these two were going to interact. But of course, it wasn't a huge problem because they didn't have any scenes together in the film. It wasn't until the studio saw how good that Bill Murray was and how good Chevy Chase was, they said, you know, we've got a huge wasted opportunity here. We need to have a scene with these two guys together. So that's how the whole scene of Carl Shack and the whole pool or the pond thing came up.
It's very interesting, too, that they had to reach back a little bit into old Hollywood to try and save this thing when they were attempting to edit it into something manageable in the post-production process?
Yeah, you know, they went through a number of editors, and it's sort of a miracle. The first cut of this movie, the rough cut of this movie, was 4.5 hours long. They had a lot of work to do, and it didn't help that they were smoking a lot of pot in the editing room. You know, when you're that high, everything seems really funny and not something you want to cut. So they had a lot of trouble with that. So, you know, they called in a series of different editors to get the movie into manageable shape. It was still a bit of a mess. So the idea that they came up with, and it's not one that Ramis or Kenny liked, but the producer, John Peters, came up with the idea, was they had shot one scene with the gopher, just one scene with Bill Murray and the gopher. And so he said, why don't we go back to the studio, get some more money, reshoot more scenes of the gopher, and just have those scenes be the connective tissue to all these great gags we have. So you could argue, I know some people don't like the gopher, but you could argue that the gopher is the thing that saved the movie.
An amiable mess, as it was called early on. Now, all these years later, and you point this out in the book, there are elements of the movie that are a bit uncomfortable to watch today in light of the Me Too experience that's going on in Hollywood right now. But how does Caddyshack stand the test of time from your perspective?
Well, it's like a lot of movies from that era. You know, it's still a very funny film, but it's also a bit of a problematic movie that, you know, I think you have to try to watch as much as you can through the glasses of the era. You know, it's they're obviously the character Lacey Underall, you know, is actually a pretty empowered female character in the movie. But, you know, the actress Cindy Morgan in the book, you know, describes some encounters that were, you know, less than politically correct, let's say. You know, she was really put through the ringer in terms of the amount of nudity she was doing, the circumstances in which she did the nudity, being threatened to be fired if she didn't do things the certain way that they wanted them done. So, you know, I think it's a movie that unfortunately is like so many other movies of its era.
Chris, did you find that the people who were in this film, those responsible for making it, they were happy to have the chance to talk about this, even though perhaps some of the memories were a bit clouded?
Yeah, you know, the thing is that, you know, I think a lot of people might dismiss Caddyshack as sort of a silly, lightweight movie. You know, Bill Murray has gone on to be nominated for Oscars. Harold Ramis went on to direct a profound movie like Groundhog Day. You know, I mean, like, you know, these are people who had careers that produced more serious, maybe more reputable movies than Caddyshack. But I found that all of them really enjoyed the chance to talk about it because it was such an important movie at the beginning of their careers. And it was really an era when they were having a lot of fun. You know, acting is a business, and this was a time when everything was new to them. And they really, it had an exciting air about it. And also, you know, they were also free and easy with the anecdotes about some of the racier stuff because it's been nearly 40 years and the statute of limitations on most of the stuff has elapsed. So, you know, they were pretty honest about it. So it was fun to talk to them.
Well, it's a wonderful read, a fascinating story of an important era in comedy, and to read about so many of these people at the dawn of their careers as well. The book is called Caddyshack, The Making of a Hollywood Cinderella Story. Chris Nashawaty, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you.